Welcome to Crossing Culture. This is Brolo Bolin with CN Kroom, exegete and founder, Brolo Bolin, host and contributor. Thank you for listening in today. Today we wanted to talk a little bit about being in the world but not of it, kind of our head tagline and what we ultimately are trying to accomplish each time we're meeting up and talking about this stuff. And one thing that was brought up by CN recently was on his Facebook, on his personal Facebook page. He was talking about Demi Lovato, and he had a little write-up, and I thought it was really well written, and we'll try and have him give us a short synopsis of what he wrote there, and then we'll have a little conversation about that, and then I think segue into some more kind of meatier topics related to that initial opening.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think what I think, and I'm gonna just do an audit here on addition here because that doesn't like where it's being saved, but yeah, I think what I was talking about originally was that Demi Lovato had come out recently with this song called Commander in Chief, and it was like, I was looking at it and I saw it maybe 2 days after it came out, and I was like, wow, it's got almost 3 million views in the first 2 days. And that was pretty phenomenal to me because I was just thinking, like, what caused that kind of like for the people who are listening to it, like, where in the world, what draws you to this, right? As you're looking at it and you're hearing it, and maybe reading some of the lyrics will give it some context. And I'm trying to also find a spot because my audition stopped recording. I don't know if that matters to you, but I guess I didn't have it set up to save in the right spot. So as usual, there's always something, but yeah,
your audio is sounding pretty decent here.
What's that?
So. Yeah, your audio's okay. Sounding pretty decent here. So.
Okay. All right. Good.
Yeah. And way better than earlier. So
good. Then we can do that. But, I think what happened when we read these lyrics, like, I'm looking at it and I'm just kind of like, wow. I guess I was amazed by it, but I'm looking at the lyrics to it. I want to see if I can pull them up here. There. So yeah. So our lyrics start off with the song, you know, were you ever taught when you were young, if you mess with things selfishly, they're bound to come undone. I'm not the only one that's been affected and resented every story you've spun, and I'm a lucky one because there are people have worse off that have suffered enough. Haven't they suffered enough? But you can't get enough of shutting down systems for personal gains, fighting fires and flares and praying for rain. Do you get off on pain? We're not pawns in your game. Commander in chief, honestly, if I did the things you do, I couldn't sleep. Seriously, do you even know the truth? We're in a state of crisis. People are dying while you line your pockets deep. Commander in chief, how does it feel to still be able to breathe? And I listened to it, like I mentioned earlier when we were talking, you know, I listened to this maybe 35, 40 times just in a row because, you know, I get that music is visceral to some people. Like, I'm one of those people where you hear the music and you are captured by the music. And because the music captures you emotionally and sensory, in terms of sensory, the lyrics, you can almost digest the lyrics without discerning them. So as I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, you know, this particular girl who has a background as a Disney kid, she's LGBTQ people. You know, she's had a spotty history with drug addiction and eating disorders, anxiety. I'm just thinking, like, what is it about the American church or America in general that these are the people that we allow to be like our moral compass? Like, these are the people whose voice we have to hear. You know, I want to talk more about that topic because something came up in between the time that you and I talked, but, as I'm looking at it, I'm just thinking, wow, you know, we as a people, we're obsessed with the people of notoriety. We're obsessed with the celebrity, right? And I'm thinking this person has more influence than the church. And she's here singing this song about, obviously, called Commander in Chief. And I don't know, the audition thing's not gonna work. But it just keeps, I gotta figure something out with it later. But where I'm listening to this person, I'm just thinking, wow, she has so much influence, and people are listening to this song that she's singing about the president. And the song is basically about how he mishandled COVID, but now that he's had it and recovered, he cares even less, right? You know, how does it feel to be able to breathe, right? The implications is that you're responsible for the death of all these people, but you were able to save yourself. And the story itself, the lyrics are so misinformed because I mean, even factually, the cocktail he took was something that the FDA and the left have constantly been saying, oh, no, we need more research on that. We need more research. We need more this. We need more that. You know, so, I mean, even from just the standpoint of what he took versus what we're able to give people, that is that's leftist regulatory red tape that is in the way of being able to provide those medicines to people. So the narrative that he's withholding something, like he's some kind of Gestapo dictator, is ridiculous. You know, and you know, we talk about lining your pockets while people are dying. It's like, well, the man has donated every quarterly check he's gotten as the president. So, you know, if you were massively in debt or a person of greed and corruption, you know, I know some presidents sometimes donate a check, you know, a year, but he's donated them all. He's taken no salary, essentially, as the president of the United States for 4 years. So, you know, some of these narratives are just like, where did you get this information from, and why? But more importantly, the point is that I think that because America's youth have been stripped of the ability to be intellectual, it's been replaced with emotionalism, right? Their universities teach them that their feelings are what's most important. They're taught that they can have their own truth separate from other truth. And so when you listen to that in particular, you start to figure out that these, like the 18 to 24 bracket, and maybe even a little bit older than that, are really emotionally fragile. Like they're intellectually fragile. So when you have a song where the music does what it's supposed to do by being slow and somber and pretty well written, even though it doesn't use that many notes on an artistic standpoint, you know, when you start to have something that has that kind of musical draw to build you in, and then you watch the video and it's a lot of emotional people, some people are signing and some people are lip syncing over the music, you know, you start to realize that because of the way our youth have been brought up, they are conditioned to be susceptible to things like this because they don't have any discernment to go along with what draws them in emotionally, right? They feel something and therefore it's true. They don't discern it. So I'm looking at this and I'm just thinking, so as the church, where do you combat this? Because you can just say, well, preach the gospel. Yeah, but we're made in the image of God with an intellectualism and a rationale and a reason. So there has to be a way also to combat this strictly on like the, you know, if you want to say sacred versus secular level, there's still got to be some way in which we should be working to win back our culture, right? Even if everyone doesn't repent and turn to Christ, which we know they won't, there's still a way in which we can affect the culture simply by winning back the academy or winning back, you know, the arts.
Well, I agree with you. And one thing that kind of came up in my mind while you're talking this time, and as we were kind of talking through this, because we previously talked through this in a couple, I mean, via text and via Facebook, but also we talked earlier this morning about the same thing. And this time we're kind of rehashing, and I think with a little bit clearer thought and probably got some meals in our stomach and all that good stuff. But one thing that occurred to me, and hopefully this is helpful and you kind of get my point in it, but what I was thinking of is in regards to what you're talking about Demi Lovato and the emotional response and the thing that popped into my head and that was that I've really thought through a lot in this whole kind of campaign era that we're in right now is that it seems so much that a lot of what's coming out is, what do you call that when a PR stunt to get out in front of something?
Yeah,
when you're
kind of
want to
off. Yeah, they want to get out in front of something. I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, so there was a instance where The Atlantic wrote an article on President Trump with a bunch of made-up facts about something that clearly never happened, and some over 20 people discredited it that were actually there. And then you find out like a couple weeks after the fact that Biden had been kind of in a environment where he had been actually using the kind of language that he was accused that Trump. So a lot of times, a lot of this stuff, like if there's one p finger pointed at one person, you kind of got to wonder where the other four p fingers are pointing. You know, who were the people that are making the accusation, and where is it coming from, and why? And I mean, when we're talking about fighting this stuff, and you know, like I've been in a situation with a, I don't know, significant other who was doing stuff, and all the while accusing me of doing the things that they were actually doing. And so those kind of things cause you to think like,
Yeah, no, I agree, and but yeah, no, I think you're right on about that. And in particular, yeah, because which if you look at the trajectory of what we've seen over the last 4 years, essentially, is that they've accused Trump of Russian collusion, only to now find out that perhaps they were colluding with China. They've accused his children of doing something when in fact maybe it was Joe Biden's child who was doing something. And as of today, this is day four of the New York Post's Twitter account being suspended, and Twitter is telling them they will not unsuspend it or unlock the account until they remove the New York Post story about Biden's son. So, if you want to talk about open election interference, there it is right there. But for all the years, they impeach him for abuse of power. Well, that's what Obama was doing for 8 years. When they want to talk about politicizing the Department of Justice, you have to keep in mind that Eric Holder straight up said that he was President Obama's wingman. If we're concerned about the nature of politicizing a department, then that's something to consider. So, yeah, I think so, and I think you're right, that it is getting to the point, and I thought that before too, where it's like, okay, if you're accusing this of something, then maybe it's something you're getting out ahead of that you've already done, so that you can come along and say, oh no, they're just making them disinformation against us now because we caught them red-handed. And it's like, really? Is that the way it really went?
You
Are you
really
sure?
gotta, you really gotta wonder. And then talking about those kind of tactics of I don't know what psychological, I guess, you know, get out in front of something. I think Nancy Pelosi at some point has brought up the idea that if the whole what do they call it, the smear campaign, where you basically make up a lie, smear somebody, and then get other news sources to report on it, and then it becomes true. And it seems like that's a lot of what this whole political era has been about. But with that in mind, there's a lot of things going on out here. Did you see the thing? I think I posted it on my personal Facebook page about Ice Cube. I can't even think of his real name right
I want
now.
to say his name is Calvin or something. But
Yeah, the black contract with America.
which was interesting, right? Because he immediately as soon as he presented to both parties, the Republicans were like, yeah, sure, whatever, we'll talk to you about it, and had some conversation. DNC doesn't even want to talk to him about it, so there's some irony there, right? Because they're supposed to be the savior of black people, but they don't even want to talk to a black man about a contract with Black America. And it's no surprise, because it goes right back to how we opened talking about, Demi Lovato and the lyrics to Commander in Chief. There are these narratives that they want to spin, and they're able to draw America emotionally in, right? They draw them in emotionally and then argue from the point of emotion, right? So they put on this show of, yeah, we want to help black people, but then when it really comes down to it, when Ice Cube comes along and says, hey, yeah, I want to talk to you about problems in Black America, they're like, no. Or Joe Biden goes on the Breakfast Club with Charlemagne the fake god and the false god, and says, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. So they go out there and they put these little shows on, trying to appear to be for the black people. But the truth of the matter is that they anticipate the black vote, they expect the black vote, they are pretentious towards the black vote. Like, it's theirs for the taking, and they know it, because they have gotten Black America completely attached to them, for various reasons, right? In terms of emotionalism, but also in terms of need. They've become Uncle Sam has become Big Brother,
Well,
to them.
I think it's a good segue into that movie Uncle Tom, because I think it was Alan West the senator for Florida.
Yeah.
Who actually brought up, he remembers as a kid, because he's what, in his 60s or something now?
Yeah, I don't know if he was a senator. He remembers as a kid, like, I know he's got some military background.
Representative.
Senator
from, I thought it was Florida senator, if I remember right, but maybe he was just a representative.
American politician. Let's see if I can pin down where he's from. I didn't recall him being a senator, House of Representatives. Yeah, he was House of Representatives.
So he wasn't a senator, but he was.
House of Representatives.
So he wasn't senator, but he was just, you're right. He only was in for, I think, a short time.
Yeah, but he's been well known. He stayed in the forefront of the Conservative Party, or the Republican Party. I won't call him the Conservative Party, because there's an actual Conservative Party out there. And they're a mess, by the way.
He brought up that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, he brought up when he was a kid, basically every black family that he knew had three pictures in their house. It was like Jesus, Martin Luther King Jr.
Black Jesus.
And JFK.
Right.
No. Yeah, but JFK, you know. And so JFK, famously, I guess what happened was, is when Martin Luther King Jr. got put into jail, they're both political parties that were running at the time. I can't remember who was running against JFK. Was it like Dukakis or something? Man. I can't remember. It was maybe farther back. Anyways, I don't remember who it was. Whoever called MLK first was the one who ended up getting the black vote, and that happened to be JFK. So, I mean, that was kind of one of the things, you know, when during the civil rights movement. I mean, that was in the era when.
Yeah, was yeah it you know, and I should have remembered Nixon too, because that was when they started televising debates, and the politicians that weren't as pretty looking started losing.
Dukakis was the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, that became a big thing in American politics, to powder up your candidates and make them look pretty on the screen, and then people started to like see. And that's right where we fell apart, right? Nixon was a qualified politician, and JFK was an actor who looked pretty, and he was able to garner more attention because the American way, man.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That whole civil rights era though was a big crossroads in a lot of way, because we had JFK was assassinated in that time, Medgar Evers, you had Martin Luther King Jr. obviously, and then you had Malcolm X.
Yeah.
And Malcolm X was taken out by his own people, Black Israelites,
the Black Hebrews or Hebrew Israelites. I can't remember what name they go by when and what era. The Black Hebrew Israelite movement.
But it's so crazy, because it's like no one really knows the truth. They don't teach it to you in school. That's for sure. Yeah. I mean, you kind of got to go and actually patch this stuff together. They'll talk about, I mean, they were talking about, you know, like the difference between Booker T and Du Bois.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, as far as like how they're, I mean, and Du Bois was the guy who later, what did he do? Renounces U.S. citizenship and become a communist?
which is ironic, because, I mean, you know, the PC wrote Talented Tenth, you know, which is now, like, I think it's amended in the back of, like, the Soul of Black Folks book. But, I mean, the Talented Tenth was a great call to the black community. So, surprising, you know, that someone would go off the rails like that, having an understanding of what it would take to bring back a people. But, you know, on that segue, I want to wrap up the Demi Lovato idea and then kind of expand on something that was there, you know, and the point of sharing that context was just that, because people are so quick to be drawn in by their emotion, right, that they don't discern what's being told to them in the midst of that, so it becomes truth based on their feelings. And it's funny, because I look around and I saw something today in between us talking earlier that had to do something Liberty was doing tonight, Liberty University. They were they were doing something called non-essential, and I guess they're going to be talking about what's going on in the States and what's happening and all. But you know, my bone to pick with it was that when I looked at all the people that were on the panel to talk, they were all political activists or Kirk Cameron. And maybe a pastor too, but I mean, with the exception of maybe one or two of Dinesh D'Souza, with the exception of one or two of them, I didn't even know who half these people were. Mm. And I'm looking at it, I'm just thinking like, but it's a seminary. It's like, to me, I'm like, why aren't your professors or like your doctoral students or your seminary students a part of that? Because, you know, I could see it for any other group. You know, if it were Young Americans for Freedom, you know, if it was YAF or something like that, or a Turning Point, I guess I get that, right? But if a seminary is going to have a discussion about the state of things in the country, you have seminary professors and theological professors and theological students that are supposed to be being trained to speak into the next generation. Why wouldn't you give them the platform to speak to the next generation? So it got me thinking about, again, coming back to the Demi Lovato point, really just bringing up the fact that sometimes in America, it seems that we have an obsession with listening to people of notoriety rather than people of intelligence. We want, and I don't mean that to say that everyone that Liberty was hosting are unintelligent people, but I mean, to the context of what's going on in America, do I really need Kirk Cameron to speak to it? Like really? We've got some pretty brilliant professors at Liberty University. You know, we've got Dr. Richard Furr, we've got Dr. Gary Yates, you know, we've got Dr. Will Height, we've got Dr. Purser, we've got some solid Chad Thornhill, we've got some really solid, well-known theologians at Liberty, and then we have students that are taking their theological PhDs or their theological DMins. That are going to be the next generation of great scholars, hopefully, in America. And I'm just sitting here wondering, for a seminary, why wouldn't you have either men of God training men of God or the men of God being trained by men of God to come out and speak toward what's going on in the community? I mean, not anyone on the panel. So, you know, it left me thinking, like, what is America's obsession with, you know, how we have a presidential race, and it's like, oh, I'm supposed to care what Chris Rock thinks. You know, we've got videos of people. I don't know if you caught that weird commercial of them like doing like a video of them like naked talking about naked ballots. Like they're all undressed, and they're like, you're probably thinking, what am I doing here naked? Well, I want to remind you about not doing the naked, making sure that your ballots aren't naked when you send them, and they're giving instructions on how to fill out a ballot. And I'm just thinking, you know, COVID has these people so starved for attention that they're willing to do anything. And yet these are the people, these are our thought leaders in America. So I'm just like, man, America's in trouble because even a seminary won't turn to the men of God for their opinion. We're still turning to Kirk Cameron and company and Dinesh D'Souza, which I get because it's partially political, and it's not that they're bad people, but I mean, if anyone was going to bring out the men of God, you would think a seminary was going to do it. So I saw that, and I was kind of just like, wow, you know, it's discouraging. Yes, I'm a theological PhD student, but I mean, anyone really, like anyone who was prominent in taking that type of program or the professors who teach it, I'm just like, those are the people that you want to talk to. At least for me to see, you know, what should the people of God be doing? What should they be thinking about what's going on and how do we handle it, or at least mix the panel up so that, you know, you've got, you know, Dinesh D'Souza and some theologian, you know. But it just reminded me of our obsession with our obsession with partiality. We prefer, well, people that are not necessarily qualified, even the kind but of notoriety.
Well, even the kind of pandering we were talking about for the ACB trials, where they were bringing up all these kind of like, we think you're idiot points. Yep. You know, emotional pandering stuff.
Yep.
Instead of like, we're going to come up with something well thought out that maybe has some kind of trailings to emotionalism. Sure. Okay, I get that, but we're just going to go to the straight lowest common denominator and pander to like the bare, you know,
the bare bones.
Just like you're saying, where there's not.
Yep, where
it's, nothing it's insulting.
It's
insulting,
and people fall for it because we've been stripped of intellectualism in America.
Oh my gosh, it's
upsetting, and you're right. I mean, here's the thing, right? It's if you're going to talk about communicating, Aristotelian rhetoric, right? Aristotle's writing of rhetoric had included a portion for speaking to the passions of people. I mean, it's a part of the exposition of text, right? We do want to appeal to emotion, right? There's a point where we want to appeal to emotion, but our appeal to emotion doesn't come devoid of our edification of the intellect. And Aristotle would point that out in his writing too, where he would talk about, you know, it has to include emotion and speech and logic. You know, he kind of points out these things that are part of communicating. But what's being done is that we're bypassing the facts, we're bypassing the logic, we're bypassing the reason, and we're going right to base emotion. And what it's doing for people is it's training them that that base emotion takes the place of everything else. So that,
well,
that's
and,
where we
and
find
even,
ourselves.
Even on, well, even on top of that, you've got like anybody who tries to bring any kind of rational conversation into the mix is being a sort of represented as like Spock or a Borg or some kind of just, you know, Data or something on Star Trek, an all rational person with no emotion, you know, like the two can't coexist somehow. And I really think, you know, even in the charismatic church in particular, I think you've got emotionalism, and we're progressive church as well. Kind of emotionalism is the thought that leads the day, and we're gonna run with our emotions rather than run with what God says. We're gonna run with our emotions rather than run with logic.
Yes.
And it's like that, and that's what I think was great about what you wrote about Demi Lovato in that statement, is because you lined it out. And if, I don't know, maybe we should put it in the liner notes for this thing as to what you actually wrote in regards to Demi Lovato, but I think a copy and paste and drop that into the show notes or whatever would be great, because I think what you wrote was very poignant in that you just lined it out and you said, here's what's going on, here's why this is messed up, and also in that, I would like to make a small appeal to, you know, heartfelt thought in like, look, this is my appeal to you on an emotional level, that yeah, having considered these things and how that makes you feel and how that makes me feel, why is that important and why do we need to think about it? And so yeah, we should drop that into the show notes because it was brilliantly written. And I don't know how much time you put into that. I tend to think maybe not much, because you're pretty good at just banging something out and having it be pretty on point.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, it didn't take very long to put together.
It was the result of
listening to the song so many times. You know, it creates inspiration as you write, and that's kind of the thing, and that's kind of the point I'm making, right? Like, it's going to some of those things that if you're one of those people like me, like I said, who have this visceral response to hearing certain songs, when you listen to it, it's going to create some sort of response in you. And for many people, that response is to empathize with the lyrics without thought. You know, for me, it is to criticize them, and I don't necessarily mean criticize them in the bad way. I think the song was actually decently written. It's well produced. I don't have a problem with the quality of it itself, just the logical assumptions that are made within it and the accusations that are made within it, right? So I think that because America's youth has been stripped down to its most basic desire, right? It leads itself by what it feels. It does what it wants. That's why people fight for the sacred right of abortion, right? Because they want to be able to, they want to have sex without repercussions, without consequences. You know, that's why people want access to certain things so that they can experience the thing that will cause the problem or the trouble or the positioning that they don't like, but then not have to actually deal with it. So I find it fascinating in our culture, one, that someone like that could have so much influence, knowing that her background brings into question her own responsibility and her own ability to discern, and yet two, that because a majority of America has been stripped of its intellectualism, its ability to discern things, it is able to be induced or entranced by that music and lay hold of the lyrics. Now, the other problem is our ethos, right? So when I talk about Aristotelian rhetoric, I'm talking about ethos, pathos, and logos, right? We're talking about ethos being the ethic, pathos being the emotion or the passions, and then the logos being the logic or the thought process, right? Those were the three things Aristotle would talk about in terms of communicating. You had to have an ethic behind it, you had to have a logical argument, and then you had to appeal to the emotion. But what's happening for us, between the people who either don't appeal to the logos part of that, of themselves, or the information or what's being told to them, the ethos is changing. That's the other part, right? There are people who are going to straight up agree with everything that's in here. Now, it's not true, but because the ethos for some people isn't well informed, they look at what is happening and they look at the back end of it and say, well, you know what? Yeah, a lot of people are dying. This is terrible. And this is kind of how I want to segue, hopefully, out of the segment to some degree. But I want to segue that by saying part of the other problem is that American Christians have forgotten that all the other countries exist. And here's how I kind of want to bring that in. So when we talk about this in the context of this song that we're talking about and some of the things connected to it that we've mentioned, we look at that and go, wow, people are dying and he's not doing anything. But we're forgetting that people are dying worldwide in 130 countries. Like, this is not some anomaly to the United States. And in terms of death per, for COVID, in terms of death per thousand, I remember it's 100,000 or 1,000, but you can look up on like a worldometer.info. It'll show you the stats, or CDC. It'll show you, like, we're in like 11th place. So, I mean, considering that we have 330 or 40 million people in America, and that we are not actually in first place is something that's being forgotten. People are forgetting there are other countries around the world that are actually doing worse than us. And we forget that all throughout Christendom with all kinds of different things, right? When we look at how bad things are in America, we go, oh man, the end must be near. These are the end days. And it's like, but we're one country. It's like, we're just one country. There are other countries that are not as absurd as we are. They do not worship at the idol of abortion. They are not completely an ethicless people or a people without mores. They are people, places where the gospel is expanding and people are coming to Christ, and those people are trying to come here and evangelize us because we're in such bad shape. So I mean, the other part of, like I said, is that so often we think we're the only place in the world. And so whatever's happening in American Christianity is the marker for all other Christianity. Like, we think we're Old Testament Israel, and we're just not. So I think that kind of coming out of that a little bit will help us, and also answers the question of what we're talking about when we talk about something like a song like Commander in Chief and the false ideas behind it, right? We're thinking, well, we'll just preach the gospel and Jesus is going to come. And it's like, well, no man knows the hour in which he's going to come. So why would you act in such a way as to say that you do? Like, why would you make the statement that you do know? Yes, you're going to go and preach the gospel, but if we are salt and light, and I think I said this in the earlier recording we may or may not use, you know, if we are salt and light, salt is used to preserve and light is used to expose. So when we talk about, I'm going to round it out here, when we talk about the phrase that we use at Crossing Culture, in the world but not of it, I'm going to bring this up again that we brought up earlier. So Brolo, you bear with me because you heard it, but for everyone else, you know, I'll say it again. When we talk about it, when we say in the world, we mean you're in it, like you're close enough to get dirty. You're close enough to get your hands dirty and involved in what's going on. And I don't mean in terms of going out and sinning and doing whatever you want, but I'm talking about that being in the world means you're actually in it. you're experiencing some of the things, like I think we used the example earlier of the prophets that went into exile with the people. You know, like Daniel, they go into exile with the people. They're still religious and still worship God. Daniel's still worshiping God, seeing, praying three times from his window a day. And yet he's given a prominent position in this pagan secular economy. And he's in it. He's there. He's making decisions. He understands what's going on in their culture. He knows what's going on in the kingdom. You can't be in the position that he was in without having some understanding of it. So you got to be close enough to touch it. You got to be close enough to be involved. But then not of it means that you look at it with a different perspective and a different principle. So you have to be where the people are, involved in the culture that exists, but see it from a different perspective. See it from a different angle. So, you know, there are some folks, yes, who can't handle some of the things that are there. It would be dangerous to them. It might shipwreck their faith. For those of you, if you know who you are, you stay away from those things. But for those of us who are strong and can endure, there's a reason that Paul says all things are lawful, but not all things are expedient, right? Because there is a sense, and I think it was 1 Corinthians 10:23, where he was talking about, yes, you are free. Christ has actually made you free. No one sin is going to cause you to lose your salvation. But that doesn't, one, that doesn't mean we go on sinning, doing whatever we want. But two, it does mean that you can live in the world without the fear that one stumble is going to cause you to destroy your salvation. And again, for the 18th time, that doesn't mean you are free to go and sin as you please and live a lifestyle of sin. But it does mean that mistakes and trip ups and stumblings that may occur, one, will teach you the lesson of your limitation, but two, also do not negate you from the kingdom of God. You know, God will give you repentance for that and give you strength anew, and you will know new boundaries. So I understand why people always want to know, how far can I go without sinning? How far can I go before I cross that line? Well, that's not the answer we're given in Scripture. We're given an answer of taking care of ourselves, being wise in what we do, understanding our own limitations, but also to know that if we're saved, we're saved. We are free from the law. We're free from the guilt of the law, for real. So go and evangelize and encourage and make disciples and be involved in what's going on in the culture. Understand the culture so that we can judge it. Because as the salt that God leaves here, if we don't judge or expose the world, who will? Because the rest of them are in the world and of the world. So they judge the world with the worldly perspective. So what's good to them may or may not be good to us, depending on what it is, right? But we have a different standard by which we judge where there are some things we can say, yeah, that's absolutely bad. You know, your drug addiction. People be like, yeah, people just do what they want to do, or their pornography addiction. Yeah, people just do what they want to do, you know. It's whatever is pleasurable to them, you know, you deal with bodily function, so on and so forth, right? But then we come back to us and understand that we look at that and go, nope, that's a degeneration of something God gave us. That's a perversion of something God gave us, you know. So we can understand what's going on in the culture. We can be in the world, know what's happening, but be not of it in terms of our mental capacity and understanding how we judge it, if that kind of makes sense. And that's what we want to try and do. We want to try and help you be able to discern those things better.
Absolutely. And thanks again for listening, folks. If you want to interact with us, you can get a hold of us at crossandculture.org on the website. And that's not the and symbol, but the word and. Also, you can engage with us on Cross and Culture on YouTube, which I believe is the and symbol.
I can't remember, but you can find it on the website if you go there.
Correct. And also, there's a Facebook page.
Cross and Culture.
Please take the time to like, share, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your family. Don't hide it from your kids. Don't hide it from your wife. Let everybody know. It's good stuff, man. And we just, if you want to engage with us more, I think Facebook would be a great place to come in, and we'd love to have those conversations and talks with you. Maybe you offer some perspective that to this we haven't seen entirely, but any way you look at it, we'd love to engage you on that and talk with you and bring more people into this conversation, and how can we be engaging the world?
That's it. I mean, and if you were, I mean, if we're asking the question, you know, obviously we've got to know our scripture, right? We can't engage unless we know the scripture, but we also can't engage it if we're hiding under a rock either, right? So knowing people who are not Christian or in the world, seeing what the art and the culture are putting out, understanding that, because that's going to help us understand the cult, art and culture. Maybe that's where they get it from. Art and culture are really reflective of a couple of things. They're reflective of, one, where your culture currently is, right? It's a reflection of what's going on in your world, but it's a reflection of the nature of man, and it's a reflection of the foibles of man and the condition of man. So we ought to pay attention to those, because people are telling us sometimes biblical things in their songs without addressing it to the Bible or crediting it to the Bible. So yeah, please do like, subscribe, share, look for the Patreon site that's on the Facebook page. There's a link there. There'll be a link in the YouTube page. But as he said, until next time, grace and peace.
Grace and peace, folks. Thanks for listening.